there, Rook?
My English name is Willie Hensley. For our family in those early years, it made more sense to live at Iqaqtoq, which is about 10 miles away along the Little Noatak. The reason being that in Kotzebue, there's no timber nearby. It was driftwood, and there was lots of competition for the driftwood. Unless you had a job to buy coal or oil, staying warm was a problem. And so for us, it made a lot more sense to live during the better part of the year at Iqaqtoq because there was a lot of alders there, and there was also timber up the river. And also there was lots of fish, not only in Iqaqtoq Creek, a lot of whitefish in the fall, but there was also lots of shefish. There was tikdalek, there was a lingcod, and ptarmigans, and rabbits. So we lived out there. And then we'd go to Kotzebue, of course, for celebrations like Thanksgiving and Christmas. And then I started going to school, of course, sporadically. But I remember in the fall time, Iqaqtoq means it's shallow. So that means it was just like a few inches deep, way out. And so when the ice was being formed, that when it can hold us up, we used to run around with a bayonet trying to fish. You know, we'd be stabbing the fish through the ice. And that was always lots of fun. I mean, it was a lot of work as soon as we were able to. You could ride in the sled, but by the time that you could get up on your feet and move, you were encouraged to get the load off the sled and help along, pushing along and pulling along. And, you know, I'd help set shefish nets in the wintertime when I got older. Of course, I chopped a lot of wood. We picked a lot of berries. I mean, we were always busy. There was no time for wasting in those days. I mean, we enjoyed life too, but the fact is that we were all engaged in livelihood back then. You help make dog feed. Not only collecting the wood. I mean, that was always one of my chores, was collecting wood and chopping wood. And then I would help make dog feed, make the fire, then feed the dogs, make the alik, we call it. And I would also hunt. When I got older, I started hunting muskrats and ptarmigans and rabbits. Oftentimes we'd help with the skinning and cleaning and help hanging fish. They would cut and I'd wash and hang the fish. We were always busy. There was plenty enough to do. People complain about not having anything to do with it. We never had that problem when I was a kid at all. Priscilla and John, Nonorar and Akpik, until he passed away from botulism, they were my early role models. And then later on, Umivik, James, one of the sons, after Akpik died, he more or less became the sort of the family head. And he was one of the reticent types who didn't say too much, was kind of lithe and wiry. And he sort of became a surrogate father in a way, you know, because he was the one sort of taking me along and sort of painstakingly trying to show me things, you know, to survive out there. So I owe him a lot as well. I can see it just as clearly now as you know, 65 years ago, almost 65. Our house in town, by the time I got into it, had been around for a while. I mean, it was one of those one-room places that had just a couple of windows, usually single pane, and oftentimes there's a hole in the window. There was very little insulation. I don't know if it was sawdust or what, but it was very cold in that house. When the wind blew and it was itralik, you know, when it was really cold and when it was blowing, oh, it was very cold. We had a little storm shed on it. That's where we lived when we were in town. It was actually better for summer use. But even then, the summer, we'd move into tents next door. But at Iqaluit, for whatever reason, we never built log. We could have. There was timber. But we lived in Ivrulik, you know, the old-style sod house. The first one we built along Iqaluit Creek. Really, one of my earliest memories was there. I was too young to be involved in the construction of that. But I do remember when we were flooded out one fall. And all of a sudden, the water was right there, and we had to scramble it in the dead of night to move over to higher ground about half a mile away, maybe. And there we put up tents, and that fall, the older brothers built another sod house up at Kemikpuk, up near Sirlyok, and that was in the trees, in the timber. So we lived there for several winters, and then built a raft, and then we floated it down and built a third sod house, which I actually helped construct, which is still standing. It's caved in, turning back to nature. But unbelievable as it may be, we had literally no furniture. And the timbers, they weren't abutted to one another. There was space, there was earth between the timbers. We would put willows on the ground to keep us from being on the ground. But we would put our kachak, our caribou skin, on top of the willows, and there'd be a log there to kind of hold it all together. And then we'd put our sleeping bags or blankets on top there. And in one corner, we had some cupboards made out of blazo boxes. That was our kitchen. And then we had this homemade tank stove with an oven in it. And we'd pile our rifles over there in the corner by the door. And get this, I used to chop a lot of wood when I was a kid, and somebody had found this plank that floated on the beach, and I thought it was going to be for kindling, so I chopped it all up, not knowing that it was supposed to be our door. And so that entire winter, all we had for a door was a piece of canvas hanging down with a piece of wood on the bottom that sort of protected us from the outside elements. When we ate, we had sort of a small removable table made out of blazo boxes again, and we'd put our food on that, and we literally had no chairs, none. We'd sit on other blazo boxes or 5-gallon cans. I mean, that was our life. Then we had one window on the top, was made out of beluga gut skin. At that time, there was any money around to speak of, and so if you bought a window, that would cost a fair amount of money. And so our cash income was generally from muskrats or other fur-bearing animals that we traded in town. And also people earned income from longshoring in the summer. And this is actually before the commercial fishing. There was no commercial fishing at that time. So that was our life. That was our housing, and we didn't have a mortgage at all. So we'd actually have just a frame. That is, we'd dig a hole here and put a pole up on the main poles. And then it wouldn't be very tall. We'd put another big timber to those two poles, and we'd have the corner poles with timbers together, and then we'd get smaller timbers to put on the roof closer together and then on the sides, and then we'd just cut cubes of sod and start piling them up. And so you had about a foot and a half or two of sod to protect you from the winter elements. So they were actually quite warm in the winter and didn't take a lot of energy to heat. For the roof, we would find some sod that was kind of soft and deep, and then we'd cut and kind of roll it up, and then we'd turn it upside down on the roof and then put some more sod on top of that. And then we'd have a kingak, a nose, for it to breathe, sort of an opening to let stale air out and fresh air in. And then we had just that one window up there. For our kanichak, usually you had some sort of a kanichak to keep the cold air from blowing in, and also to store, you know, food and rifles and other gear out there. And then on the outside, we'd have our inyisuk, our meat and fish racks, because every living thing was trying to get at your food. Dogs, you know, mice, voles, the ermines. So you had to sort of elevate them and get them out of the way. We had just a light, one Coleman lamp, and oftentimes, if we didn't have gasoline, we'd have to use kerosene. And if we didn't have that, we used a candle. And if we didn't have that, we used seal oil sometimes when we really ran out of stuff. Back in those days, we liked to play cards. We also had a game called Stars, because many of us didn't read at that time. If we got magazines like Saturday Evening Post or Life, we'd look at the pictures. But the main thing was we played a game of stars, and there'd be like two or three or four of us, and we'd start by turning the page. And if there was a star, we'd slap it. The first one to slap it got the star, and we'd keep score. And so all the way to the end, whoever had the most stars was the winner. So that's what we did with magazines. And then we'd make our own pickup sticks. Because we didn't have access to the rest of the world back then, except for what the traders brought into the town. And one game that was particular fun was carom. We call it mitigluk, I think. It was this kind of like pocket pool sort of, I mean, where you had this board and it had four corners. And you had these little round objects with a hole in the middle. They were red and green, I think, and there was one black one. It was like playing pool with your middle finger. Yeah, and it was a lot of fun. I mean, some people were very good at it because you could tup it. You know, you could shoot once and hit two, right, and to go into the pockets. And so we'd do that. We also made slingshots. We always had lots of fun with slingshots because we'd hunt with them, you know. And if you found the right strong rubber, and we'd have a leather pisup, we call it, and you had to find the right willow for your handle. So we'd hunt birds and snipes and ducks and stuff. And we also used to make a toy, really, out of an empty, like a 30-30 shell. We'd take these lead covers and melt the lead. And then we'd get a wire, and we'd take that melted lead and pour melted lead into the shell, and we'd have this kind of wire sticking up. It would firm up and get hard, and then you'd have this thing you could tie a string onto. So we'd tie maybe a 3-foot-long string, and then a real brightly colored thing out of yarn at the end, and then we'd take those and we'd fling them up way high, and then they'd come down somewhere, and they'd go all the way in except with that little piece of yarn showing, and that was sort of one of the things we did. But we also used to make itlioks, you know, which was a sling, really like a David and Goliath type sling. And I mean, you could really get good at it, actually, if you practiced and got the right round stones. You could put a lot of force behind a sling like that and do it pretty accurately sometimes. And so we'd also played molegorak, a game in the spring where you kind of played follow the leader running on top of ice pans. In reality, a lot of these games were helping you become fast on your feet, because you had to oftentimes do that when you're out hunting on the ice, you know. And so a lot of the traditional games that we did were relevant to your survival, really, your strength, your quickness, you know. We'd also do lots of traditional games, but back then it was for fun. We tried to go the highest, but you know, we didn't keep score, right? And we didn't go do fancy stuff, you know, after we did a kick. We could have probably kicked a foot higher if we take all our clothes off like they do nowadays. Oh, the guys were strong, though. I mean, Joe Airy, he could pull me with his little finger, and I was using my big finger. I mean, we had some very strong people back then, you know. I mean, you had to be, really, and fast, you know. And we'd play a game called Mana Mana, which is a running game. It really was a test of your endurance, oftentimes, and your quickness, of course, because, you know, you could go as far sideways as you could go to try to get a point, right, by going around the other team's circle. But sometimes we'd run for miles. I mean, by the time we got back, the game would be over. But, you know, you didn't want to give up, right? And the guy was trying to tag you, right? Anyway, that was always a fun game, especially on a moonlit night. Yeah. And then we played Norwegian, of course, the lap game. And, you know, we'd build rafts in the spring out of 50-gallon drums. We had a lot of fun. I think maybe 90% of our diet was sort of traditional food back then. We loved coffee and tea, you know. We'd get the sort of the basics, but that was it. I mean, you know, we'd get rice and maybe some potatoes. And if we had especially a good fur season, we'd get like slabs of bacon. But traditional food-wise, of course, we always like akutuk, or agutuk, as they say in some places. We like akutuk. But I didn't particularly care for the akutuk made out of fish. Of course, we are not supposed to be choosy. You know, even today, I like food relatively plain, because we just bake she-fish, and the fatter the better, and the crisper the better, you know. And we always ate it with sila. We had lots of ptarmigan soup, you know, we had lots of rabbit soup. And we also had kayusak, you know, the cooked cranberries. We craved sweets, in a sense, out in the country back then. And so that kayusak was particularly welcome. I always liked tiktaalik lingkod, stomach, and or maybe was it the liver, stomach, and the eggs. Oh, very tasty. And, of course, we ate a lot of seal meat back then. A lot of seal ribs, and I particularly like beluga muktuk. I like beluga muktuk, I think, more than I do bowhead, because I was raised on, you know, beluga. And I always like mipkuk, you know, the dried seal meat. My kids still love it. I love ukhrugak, you know, the blubber, the long blubber after the oil has been, you know, rendered out of it. Mm-hmm. A lot of those traditional foods I still enjoy, and, you know, some people find it hard to believe, because a lot of people perceive me as an urbanite, which in some ways I have become, but that's not the way I began. And I still have never turned my back on Niqipak. Unlike some of our people who sort of turned up their nose because the Nolormi turned up their nose at our foods and the smells and stuff, you know. But to me, that big poke of seal oil and mipkuk and nukhrugak and paniktak, and, you know, that was to me a power pack. You know, that was the energy for the body, sometimes for the dogs. You know, it was the heat and it was the light. I mean, it was a remarkable creation that they made this watertight container out of the seal skin itself. I mean, that took a lot of work. A lot of the stories had a lot of lessons in them. One of them about the orphan boy who was raised by his adopted mother, who would go along the beach and catch a seal or a walrus and eat it and never share, and a whale even, and he came home to warm up and he blew up and she paddled away on her wooden platter. The idea there is, of course, that you got to share, right? And then don't get too close to the stove. I mean, they're always complaining if we kind of tried to stay too close to the stove and kind of prevented the heat from kind of going throughout the place, right? I mean, there are lots of stories that unfortunately are no longer a part of our collective consciousness as they used to be. I would say this, that trying to plug into the Inupiaq world takes an effort, not only on the part of the recipient, but also on the part of the giver. And so I think, just like myself, I'm not knowledgeable at all, in contrast to others who know more because they have spent more time out there and among more people who had some great stories, and I have some. But you have to get off your butt and off the couch, get rid of that iPod and the computer, because in the end, you know, you're not going to curl up with your computer and say, what a great time we had in life, you know, because what you share is with other people. That's what creates the memory. And to me, the challenge for mothers and fathers and grandparents is spending the time with the children. Because what I picked up was when I was a little boy. Most of what I picked up, in so far as our language is concerned, comes from other people. And so that's why people who have had the benefit of a traditional livelihood have a lot to offer, when in reality, our society today doesn't value that. And to me, it's like every day we're losing people that have a tremendous amount of information to convey, values to convey, knowledge to convey. And I remember trying to get the system to accept a village selection of an elder to be like a culture bearer who would be actually paid as much as a teacher to help convey that sense of continuity in the knowledge of our world. And so to me, we have to take advantage of the opportunities that we have to carry on that knowledge transfer. Music and dance, stories, geography, ways of doing things. And it's there yet. We just have to capture it. As much time as I've spent in cities across the country, I lived in Washington, D.C. for 9 years as a lobbyist for Alyeska Pipeline. I made, you know, 100-some-odd trips there, you know, during the land claims years. I've been to London and Paris and Copenhagen and Berlin and Tokyo and Moscow and places like that. But, you know, I'm still very comfortable out in the country. I love being out there where the wind is blowing and you get to hear the birds and the ducks and the geese and the swans. And I love the quiet of being away out there. And so Ikatuk is a little on the low side insofar as it's right there virtually at water level, so it's a bit soggy there. So I spend a lot of time at Ivik with my nieces and nephews, and I like to walk up to this mountain. And, you know, I never did get an allotment because in those days, even though I was one of the first to find out about allotments in the 60s, I never wanted people to think that I was into it because I wanted land. So I didn't even file for one. So I'm going to have to find me a place out in the country, although there's a few family allotments, but you don't want to kind of get into the middle of a family food fight, you know? And so I like to spend time out in the country a lot, and I'm going to do more of that before I keel over. Don't feel guilty about not knowing a lot about our culture, but you do have the opportunity to actually learn a lot from people who are around you. But it does take an effort. It is a part of who you are. And when you do grow up, people outside of your hometown, when you get into the army or get into the world of academia or the corporate world, they're going to want to know about your life. And it's going to be very strange if you can't say what kind of world that the Inupiat people came from.